Welcome to Solutions OP Clinical Trials Podcast. My name is Olga and I'm the Managing Director of Solutions OP. We are a small team of experienced professionals working on clinical trials in the United Kingdom. I'll use our podcast to discuss hot topics in clinical trials and provide analysis of the latest trends and challenges in pharma and medical device industries, not just in the UK, but globally. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the latest episode of the podcast. Today's topic is the UK Clinical Trials Regulation, which was signed into a law in April 2025, and we expect it to come into force in spring 2026. So currently it's in a transition period, so I will give you a little bit more details on the main changes. I'm very happy to say that our team was involved in the initial consultation and provided feedback on the regulation. So another important thing I wanted to mention before we start is that this clinical trial regulation is affecting mainly clinical trials with investigational medicinal products and combination products. So for those of you who work on clinical trials with medical devices, please make sure you follow up on MHRA, a medical device group. They publish a lot of new information. There are lots of things that they're working at the moment, so there will be changes in medical devices too. But this particular part of the clinical trial regulation is mainly about drug studies. But let's go to the actual changes. So one of the first thing that I would like to mention is the change in language. In the past, as those of you who work in the industry and have done submissions in the UK know that we used to call them amendments when there are any major changes to documents. Now these amendments will be called modifications. Another change is that instead of approvals, and now the regulators will be issuing authorizations. So that's, I think it makes sense if you think about it. The clinical trial is authorized rather than approved. It gives, the word approval gives a different kind of meaning maybe for people. I mean, for those of us who work in the industries, it's quite clear, but it could be misunderstood when you say that it's approved. Another term that is changing is clinical trial site will be called trial location. And this is to recognize that there are a lot of decentralized clinical trials where they are spread over several locations, so they're not necessarily in one place. I think still many people will prefer to use site for the time being simply because it's shorter to put it on labels and in different places. And the last, probably the biggest change, which I quite like, is subject is replaced by participant. I have to admit, I've never been really a big fan of the word subject in clinical trials. So it's a very welcome change to participant. Another clarification in the clinical trial regulation is that you can have a chief investigator which is outside of the study and existing sites. So for those of you who don't know, in UK we have a clinical, in the clinical trials we have a chief investigator who is responsible for the overall oversight of the study and also reporting to regulatory agencies. In the past we normally use that kind of role for one of the PIs from the existing sites. However, now the regulation says that you can actually have external person. It wasn't common in the past. Maybe it will be more common in the future. But at least this is it's good to have it clarified that the person could be external from the study. There is another clarification in the regulation, and this time is regarding the ethics committees. So they specifically clarify that if for whatever reason you have a study which was approved and your ethics committee ceased to exist, you'll be automatically allocated to another ethics committee. So that's a, I mean, it's, I don't think it's a very common issue, but it's good to have clarification what happens if, for whatever reason, the ethics community is no longer there for you. Another change in terms of ethics committees is regarding the number of people which are required to attend from the ethics committee to have a quorum. So at the moment it's 7 members, and they are going to change this to 5 or more members in the new regulation. That's great. It's great news, particularly for those of us like me who sit in ethics committees, because even though we do our best to be there all the time, sometimes it's just not possible to attend. So giving flexibility to allow 5 or more people to be considered quorum, I think this is a very welcome change. And speaking of ethics committees, there's another change here, and this is regarding the definition of a lay member. So lay member means an individual who does not have a formal qualification related to or professional experience in the field of clinical research or healthcare. So that will change the classification of some of the members of the ethics committee. Well, when it comes to substantial modifications, if you remember, as I said at the beginning, they're no longer called amendments, they're called modifications. There are 2 routes. So one is route A for substantial modifications, and there is a route B for substantial modifications. So route A, you can use this one if you need to submit any significant changes which affect the safety and rights of the participants or the data integrity of the study. And you can use route B for substantial modifications if it doesn't necessarily significantly impact the participants' safety, but it provides important information. So in such cases, you can also submit as substantial modification. Another important change in this new regulation is the requirement for initial submission and to the sponsors to provide a statement to clarify that the trial is considered notifiable clinical trial. So for those of you who haven't followed on the latest updates from HRA, they released recently a tool which helps you identify if your clinical trial needs to be submitted for ethics review or not. So please do use this tool if you're not sure about your clinical trial. There are a lot of different studies. Some of them are very clear-cut and you know it's notifiable, but others could be a bit more borderline. So that's a good thing to use and identify if your study actually needs approvals. Now, speaking of submissions, there is another change in this new regulation. So for those of you who have submitted drug studies lately, you know that we have a new portal where you can submit in parallel to MHRA and Ethics Committee. Now, the new regulation provides flexibility and basically says that in some cases you might want to submit separately to MHRA and to Ethics Committee. And this is particularly helpful for small companies where they don't have so much much resources and time, especially when you submit to both regulators, you tend to receive quite a lengthy list of questions. And if it's a small company, they might not necessarily have the time, and it could be a bit of a challenging for them to meet the 14-day timeline to respond to these questions. So I think it's a very welcome solution to have that flexibility and allow companies to do it this way. For big companies, it's not a problem because they have their own regulatory departments and it's a lot easier for them to handle. But for many small companies, it's been a challenge to do that, especially if the request for change affects multiple documents and it could be quite complicated. So another confirmation in the new regulation is we have a clarification that once you submit your application, there is a 7 days validation period. And after your application is considered valid, then it will be reviewed within 30 days. Now, in cases where there is a further request for clarification, the sponsor will need to respond within 60 days of receiving the request. I think this is a very good information to have and to remember. It's mainly because sometimes we have requests for additional information and companies start delaying the responses as much as they can. And that delays the whole study. So I think it's good to have clarity on the timelines and make sure people try to submit responses within these timelines. So if you have a substantial modification at the same time, the review period is 35 days as it currently is after receiving a valid application. Another important point in the new regulation is that your clinical trial will be considered approved if you have received authorizations from MHRA and Ethics Committee. So for those of you who know in the past and have submitted studies, we used to have multiple layers of approval. So we had the MHRA, we have Ethics Committee, we had HRA, we had site level approval. So at the moment, the Ethics Committee and the HRA approvals, they're both merged into one. And hopefully that will speed up the review process, and it will be very helpful when you receive feedback at the same time from both Ethics Committee and HRA. So another important part in the new clinical regulation is that if you have a clinical trial which has a site in the UK, the regulators are allowed to conduct inspections in different hospitals who participate in the clinical trial. So that's particularly for international clinical trials. So it's something to keep in mind. Another very good, I think, for me, change in the new regulation is that you can implement non-substantial modifications without the need to submit it to the regulator. However, you still have to keep copies of these modifications and provide them to the regulators if they request them. This is particularly important because sometimes people discover typos or they want to make some very minor administrative change, and the current practice is everything is submitted to the regulators, and not all of these documents really need to be approved or submitted. It's just increased the workload to the regulators unnecessary. Of course, we'll need to have a bit of a twitch in the mindset to get used to that. Especially for those who are used to submit absolutely everything to the regulators for approval. And even for the sites, I've had in the past cases where they've identified one typo, and because of this one typo, they wanted it the informed consent to be submitted to the Ethics Committee. So hopefully this new change in the regulation will ease that unnecessary submissions of non-substantial modifications. In the new regulation, also it's clarified that the sponsor has to register the clinical trial in a public database before the first patient is recruited, or 90 days after obtaining authorization, whichever comes first. So at the end of the study, the sponsor has 12 months to publish the results after the end of the study. Of course, those of you who work on phase one clinical trials, the deferral is still there, so you can still request deferral and you don't need to register such clinical trials. Another important change in the new regulation is that the clinical trials authorization will lapse within 24 months of the authorization in case the study has not started. So if the sponsor would like to have an extension, they can have an extension to up to 36 months. I think it's important here to take a note of this and make sure that the study is submitted when we are sure that it will be going ahead and is ready to recruit. Sometimes the studies are submitted and then they start making changes in manufacturing and other things, and there are significant delays. So it is important to submit the study when you're really ready to open the study and not long in advance. One of the other changes in the new clinical trial regulation is that they extend the data storage period to 25 years. So the current period is 15 years, it makes sense to be 25 years because those clinical trials which are conducted in Europe, they're often submitted to the European Medicine Agency and the MHRA. And the European Medicine Agency has 25 years storage period. So it will be a lot more complicated if they need to retrieve data and they need information if our storage period is only 15 years and our data is part of the whole data which is submitted to European Medicine Agency as well. So from that point of view, I can see why 25 years is reasonable in this case. In terms of safety reporting, so any suspected and expected serious adverse reactions which occur in the course of the clinical trial in the UK and is fatal or life-threatening should be reported as soon as possible to the MHRA, no later than 7 days after the sponsor was first aware of the reaction. Any other seizures that occur in the UK should be reported within 15 days. So that's one of the changes. So in addition, the sponsor will have to provide annually information, a list of serious adverse reactions, a description how any safety concerns were assessed and managed, and description of the overall safety profile of the drug. This is not something new. We still have to provide this information, but now it's included in the regulation, and hopefully companies will be more compliant in providing this information to the regulators. Another important part here is that they specifically clarify that you have to provide these SUSERs to the regulators. It does not mandate that you have to send them to the investigators for review and approval. And I think this is very reasonable. For those of you who've worked on oncology clinical trials, you know that there are sometimes in some phase 3 studies and phase 2 even, there are so many serious adverse events and so many SUSERs reported. And in the past, all the investigators were supposed to review these and even sign them off that they have reviewed them. And it's a really huge burden for the clinicians. And we need to be a bit more sensible about this burden and try to provide them adequate information which is actually meaningful for them. I mean, sending them all these users from around the world, some are initial, some are follow-up. Of course, they won't remember the initial one so that they can read the follow-up after that. It wasn't really helpful. So I think from that point of view, it's great to provide investigators once a year with a summary of safety information and information which is really relevant for them and that they can use. Now, of course, if you have any urgent safety measure or something else happening, you need to notify them. But for general SUSERs, which are more or less not that urgent or critical, I think it's absolutely reasonable to provide that information periodically and not just to ask them to review every suicer. Another big change in the new regulation is that now the GMP Annex 13 for labelling of investigational medicinal products is included into the new clinical trial regulation. So if for whatever reason your labels are not compliant with Annex 13, please make sure you update your labels to be compliant. It's very important. And the last one, but not really the last one, it's quite an important change, is the regulation allows flexibility on insurance by considering other arrangements, which is very important for observational studies. So basically, if you have observational study which doesn't do anything to the patients and it's just collecting data, you can use the contract and the indemnity clause in the contract to cover in case something happens, to reassure the site that you'll be paying for any compensations or anything which is required if anything happens, and not go through insurance. The reason for this particularly is there are quite a lot of real-world evidence studies that are ongoing at the moment. Many of them not really doing anything to the patients at all. They're just collecting retrospective data. So it makes sense in such cases that they'll be able to use the contract instead of issuing insurance. So these were all the changes from me on the clinical trial regulation. Of course, in the new course, we'll have a lot of guidance and different documents to help us with the interpretation. I hope this information was useful for you. Thank you for listening.